and welcome to the LRM podcast, sponsored by Adrian Flux Insurance. I'm Martin Dominey.
And I'm Steve Miller.
And today, we're at Richard Chassis.
What a lovely place to be.
So if you've been listening to the podcast in any capacity over the last nearly a year, can you believe we've been doing this nearly a year?
We need to do a special episode for our 52 one.
Our annual special.
Annual special.
Yeah. Anyway, you'll know that Steve is currently building up his 1984-90, slowly, admittedly, but he is building it up. And part of that is getting a new bulkhead.
So we're here to collect it, which is really exciting. I've had a little glimpse of it. It's outside, ready in a stooge.
It does look fantastic. But no, the Richards team have been very gracious in giving us a tour of the facility.
Far too long.
But thanks ever so much for having us. Yep. So we're... After you, go on.
Oh, after me? Right.
On, you do the intro.
So we're sitting here with Alistair and Duncan of Richard's Chassis, and giving us a bit of a tour around. And since the last time I came here, which was, we worked out probably over 10 years ago now, that's how fast time flies. Because the last time I was here, you did a stage one V8 chassis for me, for the project. And to say this place is expanded is an understatement. It's like twice the size.
Yeah, we've put a warehouse on the end for storing chassis in, completed chassis, and we've put some workshops on there and a specialist sort of build bay for doing sort of new stuff, restoration work and stuff like that, and new projects. So probably come to those in a bit.
When you came, did we have both these units or is it just the one?
So the offices have changed. We were upstairs and then now we're downstairs, and then obviously the... Yeah, no, it's doubled.
We started with this one.
Yeah.
Then we bought the one next door, which effectively doubled.
Which was when I think you came. So I think we were in that, they were fitting chassis in that unit.
So where the jigs
door.
Are now, that's where the chassis was made.
Yeah.
But there was a laser cutter which has since moved, hasn't it?
Yeah.
That was
yeah.
in the corner of the same room.
Moved, it's totally changed.
I mean, it's completely.
It's about three times the size of the original one.
It's crazy. But that just obviously shows how much like Land Rover is in need of, well, most people's old Landers are in need of new chassis, aren't they? So
I was going to say, too, we were talking about the premises here. If you look at the April issue of Land Rover Monthly, Greg King did one of his A Day With series on Richard Chassis. So get the mag out and have a look through that, and you can sort of put together bits of the place that we're talking about. It's an incredible place. Like, I've never been before. This is my first time here. But yeah, to see how things go from tiny laser cut brackets and bits of metal to a full-blown galvanised chassis ready to go under a Land Rover is amazing.
Because you were saying earlier, Alison, there's like 380 different variants
Build roughly 380 different types. It's mainly the series ones that are the problems. Yeah, we start with the series one. I think there's nearly 30 different versions of an 80 chassis before you even get to... 86 and 88 series ones, and then all the series ones, there's left-hand drive variants, right-hand drive variants, military variants, stage ones, trucks, station wagons, series two, series threes, and then you get to Defender, and it all starts getting a bit simpler at Defender. But whereas Land Rover only build one chassis at a time, we build well over 300 different variants any one time, so we just have thousands of parts kicking around for thousands of different chassis.
Discovery 2s. You wouldn't think there are 8 variants of Discovery 2, but there are.
No, you wouldn't think that. No.
Yeah. And there's not a single common part between Discovery 2 and Defender.
Yeah.
So you think they're roughly the same thing with a different body on.
See, for me, when we did the tour earlier, just looking around all the shelves of all the, like a deconstructed chassis, and you were testing us on, like, what's this, what's that, right? I have no idea what that is. So as you said it, you recognise it, but when you see it in its individual component form.
So it's quite fun to sort of try and you were testing us on what they were, and it was like,
it looked
so familiar, but I couldn't figure out where it was from.
Can I just say they failed dismally?
Yeah. You chucked us right under the bus.
So basically, we wouldn't be an apprentice here.
Plus, I can't really weld very well, so that'd be, it'd be a lost cause.
Not too bad, are you?
You're better at welding than I am.
Yeah, but...
We used to have a chef that worked here, and he actually turned into a really, really good welder when we finished training him, but...
So often the way we like to get people is people who actually want to work and learn something are often better than people who think they know everything.
Okay.
So you can teach them what they need to know.
Yeah.
And
As long as the important welds are done by the guys who are coded and got all the qualifications, that's fine. But
of course, you've got somewhere, haven't you?
Yeah, there's a lot of guys.
You know, you can teach the basics of welding relatively quickly. But it's how they apply it, and some of the better people, not necessarily start out as welders.
There's a lot of guys here that just tack stuff up.
Yeah, everyone's got to start somewhere.
So, yeah, yeah.
And then we train them as we go.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. So do you see a lot of that? Is there a lot of development where you'd say you had a chef come work with you and he now, turned into a great welder? Is it about promoting people within the business and getting their skills up?
Definitely can.
Try to, yeah. I mean, it's a very small skill set. You know what I mean? You can get somebody come in and weld something together, but it's not necessarily just about the welding. It's about, a lot of it is about knowing the product and which bracket goes where and what it should look like when it's done. So a lot of it is trying to train the guy to be familiar with the product as opposed to being able to weld a weld.
As in, that weld should only be come up to that point there and no further.
Right.
Because a washer.
Yeah,
that bolt might interfere with it.
So
it only goes to there.
Down.
Don't keep going. Yeah.
Yeah. If we're doing a replica Series 1 chassis, you know, all the downward welds are 1/3 weld, 1/3 miss, 1/3 weld.
Okay.
Okay. That's the thing. Yeah, they're all like that, and we can tell if something's been replaced on a chassis because everybody just welds all the way down.
Right. Yeah. So, attention to detail, isn't it?
So and when you're doing a chassis that's £3,000-4,000 for a Series 1 guy, and it's a replica of something that's going on an expensive vehicle, they want it right. They want everything bang on it. And if you can replicate that for him and give him the best product you can that way, then everyone's happy, aren't they?
All the Series 1s are made to the chassis number, not the year.
It's not a generic one-size-fits-all Series 1 chassis.
Yeah.
Like I said earlier, I think there's 30-some-odd, 80 chassis alone, so...
They were changing by the month often. They were working out how the hell they were going to make everything, and they changed regular and often.
So, I was just going to touch on this. It's like this is a fairly, not new, but something you're going to try and sort of develop, I guess, is
the restoration side,
as well as obviously supplying chassis all over the world for Defender and Discovery rebuilds.
For a long time, we've only made new chassis. But because of that, we do have a lot of knowledge of what should be when and where, or from when and where. So why not help people who want things restoring as well?
There's all that knowledge now. All the old boys have that knowledge, and all the old boys, unfortunately, are leaving us. They're all reaching an age where, unless they pass that knowledge on to other people, it will be lost. You know, how does the wiring work on an 80? You know, you could research it and learn it, but then the old boys all know how that works, don't they? They just look at it and go, well, you've done that wrong, and you go, okay, that's fair enough. Yeah, I've usually done it wrong.
Really important to keep those skills, isn't it? Otherwise, we're all going to be a bit lost, aren't we?
That's why my lad, he's 26 now, but he actually went away and learnt and worked with the old boys. And realistically, that's
sure
how...
Feel like being called that one.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll love it. Pete Stringer, bless him, he's a fantastic guy. But we kind of learnt that from Steve Walker in the early days. He was an old boy who had all the knowledge in his head, nothing written on paper.
He wasn't that old when we met him.
He wasn't that old, that's 40 years ago. So
you came here as kind of like, what, apprentices originally? Or
we didn't come here, we went into a shed behind somebody's house in Woodlands in Doncaster.
Talk us through the very beginnings of Richard's chassis.
Richard's chassis ultimately started with a guy called Steve Walker. He was a bit of an eccentric dude, still kicking around now. He lives in the club, has his pint. Very dry sense of humour, plays a fiddle.
And a banjo.
sing some very dodgy Irish music and things like that. Lovely bloke. And he had this idea just to build some chassis. He wanted to build a 109 Series 3 station wagon for his vehicle.
Okay.
And somebody said, can I buy that? So he sold it and started making another one. And we were there with him during this time, making bits and stuff like that after school.
When we were about 16.
16, so this is 1984-ish. John Marsland had just set up Marslands as well.
Okay. Because
he got the series jigs from Land Rover to do their warranty work on their stuff, because they were all moving over to Defender.
Right.
So,
you know, Land Rover obliged to keep warranty parts for 10 years.
10 years or whatever. So John Marsland took over the sort of series stuff. Steve Walker set up as a kind of rival to him, so they were always there.
I'm not sure which one happened first.
Yeah, sort of there, the thereabouts.
Steve initially wanted a chassis. It was Land Rover wanted thousands back then for him. And he said, "I'll make my own then." So. Yeah, that's how it all started.
So that's kind of where it started, and then
he started employing local people out of work,
ex-miners and things like that.
And on the back of the miners' strike,
right?
Yeah. Wow,
he was starting to give people work locally from that, and then it just snowballed.
It went massive. I mean, they ended up in a dirty, great big unit. I mean, twice the size of this unit here, out in Thorn, and it got people. But instead of laser cutting and stuff like that, they were doing all the holes were punched or drilled, and things were formed by cutting them on shear machines and then radiusing tops out.
So really labour intensive. Massively
labour intensive.
I was plasma cutting.
Yeah, with plasma cutting by hand round templates to get rail shapes out and stuff like that.
And then you get four rails together.
Weld them up.
Tack them on the edges.
Grind the edges, so they were all the same shape. Yeah.
We had a vice on a tripod, so you put the rail in, and then just get them all more or less the right shape. Then it would come out of that, put a stamping jig on, stamp where all the holes were,
drill.
And then it goes onto the drill, which we've still got over the road.
That's mad, isn't it?
So labour intensive.
So hole saws and drill bits.
So in terms of like man hours to build a typical chassis then versus now,
it's phenomenal.
I mean, you're probably talking, I mean, roughly at the minute, we're probably about 8 or 9 man hours per chassis.
Bear in mind,
at the minute. But a lot of the stuff's covered off with automated welding systems you know, cabinet welders, laser cutting instead of hand forming.
Virtually everything was made with a guillotine.
Press, you've seen the fly press, you've still got it.
We'd get a sheet of steel, and we'd have a template, scribe out the part we wanted. And guillotine it off, shear it.
It was literally that labour intensive.
That's really hard.
It didn't even realise it was
40 guys making 12 chassis a week or something like
that.
Wow. Yeah, so it was proper labour intensive, and all the profit went into paying the lads because
They don't know the bone.
Steve was really good at sharing out the profit amongst the lads and us having a pay scale to match up with them. But he left him a bit short when it came to things like, oh, we need to buy 3 new welders.
Yeah, so running an actual
business. Where's our bonus?
Lads
don't like giving up the bonus to buy new welding machines.
Because of things like that, he got built up and then
kind of imploded.
Kind of gave up on it.
Yeah.
And it went downhill from there, and I think he just sort of semi-retired. We went off and did other things.
You went off welding, didn't
you? I wasn't a welder then. I was helping out doing frame changes.
Okay.
And then I went off and...
Became a welder. Got all these qualities and what have you.
Yeah, became a welder. And then I worked at the same place for, 12 years or more. Yeah. And it was a machine shop with 2 welders, and I was one of them. And he used to do a lot of things for the railways. So I'd be working on a 1948 drawing for something that dropped sand in front of a train, and they're still using the same copper pipes and
fascinating.
Or little bosses with a little thing with a boss either side, make 200 of those, so you'd rattle those off. So I did a lot of things like that, but some of the drawings were from decades before I was even born.
Works
about proper anorak and have them on his
wallpaper. You wouldn't think in the 90s that would still be. They'd still be using, but same British Rail.
Wow, that's cool.
So I went off and learned how to build boats, and then obviously I went to
boats or fiberglass.
Fiberglass. Fiberglass, yeah. I can't work with wood, you can't weld it.
No.
It's a no. problem.
You cut a bit out, you can't put it back.
No,
it's a bit of an issue. I'm not that accurate, I'm afraid. Well,
interesting. So were you Land Rover enthusiasts back then?
Not really.
I mean,
I do like a Land Rover, but I've never been. Well, we've owned a few over the years, obviously, but
quite a few.
That's
but over a lot of years.
Sort of Discoveries are more my sort of bag, but even then, now there's just.
I've had a few 110s here and there.
Yeah.
But, we are having a Land Rover built as we speak, but it's a bit special.
For work or play?
It's meant to be a show Land Rover.
Okay.
So it's going to be. So Ricky's building it down at RAC Components.
Oh, we know Rick, yeah.
Yeah, and he builds a nice truck.
Yeah, he does. That blue one that he brings to the shows that he puts up on.
And he also works at DDS as well. So he's quality control guy down at DDS.
I only found that out the other day because I think I saw something on YouTube and he was showing somebody around. So I was like, what's Rick from RAC Parts doing at DDS?
We're just sending pictures of stuff that's not quite right, and he just sends about up, for God's sake.
But he doesn't say that.
No, he doesn't say that at all. There's a few expletives going there as well.
A podcast.
He says, oh heavens.
Oh dearie do me, that appears to have gone somewhat wrong.
And you know, in a way, we're part of his quality control as well, because you know, we're using their products.
Yeah, of course.
Feedback is always good. No matter who you think, how clever you think you are, feedback is always good.
So they'll bring in like their cross members to go onto your jigs.
Well, some of them are our cross members that they build for us.
Yeah.
And then they sell stuff out as well that's ours. But we've worked together with DDS for many, many years now.
Fair few bits of their tooling.
And between us, we own a load of the old SPI tooling.
Ah, yeah, that's quite. So, can you tell us that story?
SPI were a Canadian company that used to make fuel tanks and all sorts of Land Rover parts.
Spectra Premium International.
Yeah, Spectra Premium.
That's a fancy name.
When you said that name earlier, I was like, I remember that name. When you said Canadian, I thought, it's a fuel tank. Because they used to make fuel tanks.
Sounds like bad guys from Thunderbirds.
So just one day they decided they'd had enough. And packed up.
Pulled out of Europe and just
sold everything off. So we had this big scramble around.
We had no money.
To try and rate. We just took every single penny we had.
But what would be considered no money now?
Back then we had that much. Yeah.
You know, I think we spent £30,000 on tooling and just spring seat tooling and stuff like that. Rear cross member tooling. And then we were literally down to the wire. We weren't running an overdraft at the time. We borrowed every single penny we could get, because without all that tooling from SPI, because one day they rang us up, they said, oh, we're closing, do you want to buy this stuff, because if not we're going to sell it to somebody else, we're going to scrap it. If it don't get sold, we're going to scrap it. Right, okay, so you're not just going to give us the tool. No, you're going to have to buy it or we're going to scrap it.
That's a bit of a ransom, isn't it?
Okay. Well, it kind of is, but it's, I mean, we spent every single penny we had, and then we've got all this tooling that weighs tons and tons, and it's no machines to run it on.
Was the tooling all in Canada as well?
No, tooling was all in Coventry.
Oh,
okay.
they were supplying obviously to Europe.
But the point was, if that stuff wasn't made, we were out on our ear.
We wouldn't have a business if we didn't have that access to that tooling. So there'd be no spring seats, because that was the only press spring seat tool in the country at the time.
Okay.
And I think it might still be now. No, I think GKM.
Somebody else has got them.
Sure, somebody else might have one somewhere, but. So we got that, and we got some rear cross member tooling and a few other bits. On about 3 days after we'd nearly bankrupted ourselves, and we're wondering what we're going to do with all this tooling,
how
we're going to make stuff off it. We had one 100 ton press that went about 1 inch a minute.
Eventually
it pressed something. And got this phone call off Des, and he says, you've just bought all that tooling. You know, so, yeah, can we have it so we can run it?
Can we come to
Des? Yes, just help yourself.
Come to some agreement with this. And we've worked together ever since, because you know, they desperately needed what we got in and bought.
And we, right, and we they've got other stuff. They'd bought stuff as well that we wanted to buy off them, and it was like, well, this is simple,
perfect,
isn't it?
Yeah. Really.
This is simple. They were a small business trying to grow. At the time, we were a small business trying to grow.
There were three people that were working at SPI when it shut down. So instead of taking, man, you shouldn't really talk about their backstory, but you know, instead of taking,
they did take redundancy money. They took as much tooling.
They were
as
able to take tooling and set up.
Okay.
To cover their redundancy money, so they could set up a business.
Right.
But we jumped in and bought some bits they wanted.
So
we,
I see. So
we
bought some stuff. You needed to kind of work together.
Dave Dean is a tool mate, and Des is just a salesman extraordinaire. I mean,
okay.
He's so good. I mean, he loves the sale. He loves the deal.
Yeah,
he loves getting the stuff sold. He's
constantly
brilliant guy,
on his stuff, looking to see who's contacted him, who he needs to talk to.
You can't go on holiday because you get emails. Aren't you on holiday, Des? Yeah, but I've seen this. You need to buy it.
Yeah.
So between us, we've had this really good relationship, and they've helped us develop the bulkhead tooling. Well, they've developed the bulkhead tooling. We're manufacturing it, and then they sell it, and we sell it.
They make a kiss of parts. We put them together.
Yeah,
same theory as the chassis.
Lot,
you know.
Yeah, we still make a lot of Land Rover parts here. Yeah, you know, the chassis parts. Mm. We used to make a lot more.
Right. Yeah. The big items, the mass-produced items like the A-frames for all our Defender stuff, they put them together down there. They have a cabinet welder. You'll go in, the cabinet welded up. We bring them back here, put the final dressings on them, and send them out. You know, attach them to chassis. All the spring seats, jack mounts. Rod points, we have new tools for rod points this last 4 or 5 years.
You see a chassis with a 2mm jack mount on it. Why is it 2mm? It should be 4mm.
Yeah.
And they are out there.
Yeah.
They're hard to make in 4mm. They're a lot easier to make in 2mm, but they're not strong enough, let's be honest.
Right.
And you're listing your 2.5-ton vehicle upon some 2mm jack mounts.
Yeah, yeah.
Good luck to you.
Interesting, isn't it?
So we work with DDS a lot, and then I like to form relationships in the business. So, we've worked with Gigglepin and Jim Marsden down at Gigglepin.
At one point, extensively.
Extensively. I mean, we built the chassis for Bad Penny. That was a good bit of fun, because Jim says, can you put it on a diet? I said, what do you mean? He says, I want to make it 60 kilos lighter. And we're like,
which is quite, because the chassis tends to weigh what?
140-ish kilos. Sure.
Yeah, so it's quite a significant weight saving, isn't it?
Yeah, so Jim in his wisdom, and I think he's quite, when it comes to racing cars, he certainly,
he knows his stuff.
He knows his bits, doesn't he? But then he came to us and said, oh, I want to build a chassis in 2mm, but it's got to be for the race car. And you'd seen our race car chassis.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So, but he says, I want to strip all the weight out of it. And we said, right, how are we going to do this? So we turned it into a colander. We just literally cut, I think there was 300 extra holes, 2-inch holes we put in it.
Dimple-dyed.
And dimple-dyed them. So the top and bottom of the rails just dimple-dyed.
The A-frame cross,
which adds extra strength anyway, doesn't it?
Because if it wasn't
dimpled, I suppose.
But it effectively reduced the weight of each piece of metal we put on by a third.
And the metal thinks it's, you know, 4mm thick instead of, in Jim's case, 2mm.
And if he hasn't wrecked the chassis, then it's never going to be wrecked, is it?
Well, if Jim can't break it, then it isn't going to break.
No.
And Bad Penny, he still has now, and I don't know how old it is. It must be 10, 12 years old.
Cracking on, this thing, isn't it?
For context, if you're not familiar with what Jim Gigglepin does, he races extreme off-road events all around the world, and Bad Penny's one of his race vehicles.
Well, Bad Penny's his chassis car, and then he has the car he calls Mistress, which is a full tubular flappy suspension thing.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
But they're both running silly 7-litre V8.
Well, LS
motors and automatic gearboxes and 40-inch tyres and all this lot. And Bad Penny's kind of the he took it to, I think he took Bad Penny over to King of the Hammers, and he said it was like taking a pea shooter to a cannon fight. it was like the cars out there are mental, but he did a lap and he got round and he did the course in it So, but I mean, he's tried to destroy it numerous times, and he sold it once. bought it back, so it can't be separated.
I think that's why it's called Bad Penny, because it came back.
Kids are coming back like a Bad Penny. So
that's what I assume.
But I mean, that car's amazing. We took 60 kilos of weight out of the chassis, and Jim did a few extra things and added weight back onto it.
It wasn't the first one we'd done for him.
No, we'd done one before that, and then we did his SV as well.
A bit more extreme.
Dan Dew with From Demand Engineering, who you just spoke to recently.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago, wasn't he?
His 130 project, and he's fitted a fair few of our chassis down there, and his 130, along with the Trevor Cuthbert stuff that we're chucking stuff into Ireland. And
some regular readers of LRM will know Trevor because he's been with LRM since the beginning, 1998, building numerous Landovers,
contributing to the tech section, doing a fine job.
And Trevor was blagging chassis from me back in as far back as 2004.
I'm just saying, make sure Trevor listens. So back in the early days, I've been with
forming business partnerships.
It was a mutual collaboration.
We don't say hello to him anymore. We just say, "What do you want?"
Because obviously he's your Irish, so he sells them in Ireland.
He's the guy who basically transports our product over to Ireland and rounds customers up out there and stuff like that.
It's not so much that he buys them off us. He'll come over, he might buy one or two, but then he'll go back with other customers.
Six or eight back with him.
To pay for the ferry, because it's
expensive.
He's transporting stuff over there. Because what he does is he comes here, drops the trailer off here, goes down, gets drunk with Dan all weekend down at Demand Engineering, rocks back up here on Monday morning with a hangover, and drives back up to the boat.
Top secrets. Yeah.
These are unfounded allegations.
All alleged, completely alleged. I'm sure that doesn't happen at all.
But Trevor's been a great fan of ours from the early days. He did plenty of articles in the early days, and fitted chassis and has done all sorts on it. And then he was one of the first guys to do a bulkhead fit as well, when we were prototyping the Defender bulkhead.
Right, because he gave me the heads up. He goes, "Oh, you need to keep an eye on these guys because they're doing a secret project." I was like, "Well, what is it?" He goes, "Well, I can't tell you." I said, "Bulkhead?" He went, "No, I can't tell you." I'm like, "Okay, that must be bulkhead."
I think he had bulkhead number four.
Okay,
and fitted bulkhead number four.
Because he's doing it.
So that's how early we were in our production process that we knew we were right on those.
All day, every day, Trevor fits chassis to Landers, doesn't he? So he'll know if it fits or not, won't he? He'll give you
If you've got a product that's right, it's the time saving that comes along with it. We know garages that have a couple of prices depending on whose chassis rolls up at the door.
Actually, I had a guy talk to me a show about this. He said, "I've got a friend." He said, "I've got a friend who he fits chassis," and he says, "He's got a price for yours. Then he's got a price for that one, and a price for that one, and a price for that one, depending on whose it is, how much he loads the price up."
Ours is the cheapest because he can get it on and off the ramp in 3 days.
Okay, interesting.
We're trying.
I suppose it's like evolution, not revolution, isn't it? Because it's taken you like, 40 years as Richard Chassis to be...
The aim of the business is to try and build a chassis as close to the original Land Rover design, because there's nothing wrong with it. People say, "Oh, they go rusty and all this lot." The problem is, they're looking at it and they're not going, "Oh, it's a 40-year-old vehicle. I'd expect it to have a bit of rust." They just go, "Well, the chassis is rotten." A 40-year-old blooming... I don't want to disparage anybody, but there's not many 40-year-old Escorts or Fiestas out there, is there?
No, not really. No, they're built to a price. They're built to be scratching
The design life of a Land Rover is probably...
We expect a lot from Land Rover, don't we? Really, yeah. If you think about the harsh environments.
Well, Land Rover give you a 3-year warranty. After that, they're not really bothered about it. No, they want you buying a new one, sir. We would still like to come and test our new Defender.
Yeah, we've had people come in to have a chassis swap with Paul over the road there, and they've been logging with it, in the woods. In the woods, they bring it in, and we go... You can put your fist through it, but it's still been working. Yeah. It's still been towing a 3-ton trailer.
Yeah, it's scary, really, isn't it?
And there's just bits hanging off it. What's that? Working.
We had a lad from Ireland come over and he says, "I want you to build me a chassis." And I said, "Yeah, no problem. What do you want?" He says, "I want a heavy duty rear crossmember on it." And I said, "All right, what do you want that for?" He says, "I tow a I'll tow a heavy trailer. I said, yeah, but how heavy is heavy? And he went, well, it's actually a water bowser and it weighs 12 tons. And he's been dragging it out of a boggy field in Ireland behind his defender.
Yeah.
Right? And he says the rear cross member's slightly bending outwards, so he wants so a heavy duty rear cross member.
A rusty old rear cross member, standard.
Sounds like an easy thruster.
And he's still towing things out with it. 12 ton people get worried about having a 6mm rear cross member on.
Yeah, it's great, yeah.
Why?
There's nothing wrong with the design of a Land Rover chassis, it's just terminal tin worm, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
And you can't be that.
Just what you get in the UK and Ireland, obviously. It's just the nature of the country, isn't it? The weather, the climate, the salt. But they don't do badly, do they?
No, but the moral of the story is, you know, you've got a chassis that's done 40 years, it doesn't need to be, you know, 8mm plate or 6mm plate.
You don't need to lug around a 4mm thick chassis.
There's a lot of extra some people ask
for it. It'd be like carrying you lads around.
Why? Yeah, especially after 4K Friday.
He spent longer looking at you than me.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I'd probably do.
I've got youth on my side.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what? You might have it on your side for now.
Yeah. What? How have you seen the trend in people? Obviously, buy your chassis predominantly to keep Land Rover going, and also to restore them if they're doing a full rebuild. How's the trend changing? Has it been series and the Defender is still strong and Discovery's coming in? Or what sort of... Tell us about that.
I would say to you, up until about 2 years ago, surprisingly, it was still a roughly 50-50 Defender to series.
Right.
Okay.
We were making nearly as many series chassis as Defender up till about 2 years ago. And it's kind of slipped to 70-30 now. But I think the market for Land Rovers has completely changed. It's not a working vehicle anymore. It's a Chelsea tractor. It's full of Bentley stitch leather.
Yeah.
And they're getting sold over in the States for $250,000.
That's not everything. But there's less people at the bottom of the market.
There's less people.
Yeah, there. Yeah. What we call the sort of grassroots.
Yeah.
Yeah, the landing and off-road market.
I think those guys have now gone into D2s because they're still at the moment affordable. Right, the Defenders, they're looking at you know, even broken, beat-up Defenders are fetching strong money for what they are, really. But I think, you know, we're doing so many D2 chassis at the moment. We're building two a week, D2 chassis.
That's really encouraging to hear that people are putting
Well, we thought they were going to be a flash in the pan as well. We thought, well, we'll have a couple of years of those.
Because I remember when you first talks about D2 chassis, but then it was a case of like, you'd only really want to sell them to a professional garage to fit them because it's a bit, they're less forgiving, aren't they, the bodies on.
Yeah,
there's a little bit more to it, but
there's a bit more work in fitting them, but I mean, generally you're leaving the whole body in one lump.
Taking kind of easier, isn't it?
Gutting half of the interior out of it, and it's almost a monocoque body. Top of a ladder frame chassis, whereas a Defender's very much a ladder frame chassis and some.
There's a few ways to change
flexible
chassis,
aluminum.
There's the way where you just pick it up, wheel out the rolling chassis, swap it, and bang it underneath,
drop it back down again, and bolt it back up, or you take it apart panel by panel.
Restore every single bit on it as you go, and one takes as little as a weekend if you really know what you're doing, and the other one takes you 4 years.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
4+ years in Steve's case.
Yeah. And that's on the Defender, not on Discovery. Imagine if I had a Discovery too.
You're flying along in 4 years. Yeah. I've had a project on the go out there for 9 years. I mean, just...
The thing is, when you, like for us, excuse number one here, when you're working in amongst Land Rovers and you're doing all the shows and the magazines stuff, the last thing you want to do really is kind of work on your own stuff.
Yeah, that's what ARAC Parts are building ours now. Because my project that's gone on for years and years, it's on its third chassis now.
Okay.
Because we went, and now I'm going to change that, I'm going to do something different. I build another chassis for it and a stick.
Something standard, is it?
Yeah, stick something else under it. Because the project is, it's a full 100-inch Defender chassis with body to suit, you know, extended king cab, single panel side on it. Ricky's done an amazing job on that. It looks fantastic. But the chassis is Discovery 2 running gear, TD5 auto engine and box, right? Discovery 2 axles, the whole works, right? And it
all coils.
I want to make a Defender that drives like a Discovery 2.
It almost sounds like Land Rover should have built that.
Could have been, couldn't it? The next iteration on after they well, after TD5, really, would have been the ideal time for them.
Imagine it's got a turning circle and everything.
Oh, yeah, amazing, yeah. Very different, yeah.
There's a guy at a show walked up to us and said, we got this running gear at a show a couple of years back, and he said, can you do one with Discovery stuff on? He's leaning on it.
Just like that.
He says, what have you got in mind? Something like that. We love that.
Don't mind, but it helped. Dirty great big 20-inch alloys and straight off a Discovery 4 that were underneath it, and it looked absolutely amazing.
He was so excited.
Yeah, amazing. But the only problem now with Discovery 2s is bodies are rotting, aren't they now? Whereas it was always Discovery 1.
I think you'll find they were rotting then as well.
Yeah, they were. But it's come. We get quite a few calls and emails from people looking for panels for Discovery 2s now.
Back in the early days, though, it was Discovery 1s. Right. The bodies used to rot for fun, but the chassis were absolutely lovely on them. So we never bothered making a Discovery 1 chassis until recently. But it was Discovery 2s, the chassis used to rot for fun. Right, yeah. They just used to rot around the plastic fuel tank in the back. You'd end up with four corners and a fuel tank floating in midair and a caravan hooked on the back of it. And jeez, that's scary, not going well.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
It. So we started making D2 chassis because ostensibly they are a lovely car.
Yeah,
they're a brilliant car.
Right. Yeah.
V8 one on gas. Oh man, that's going to be the best way, isn't it? Stuff dreams have been of it all.
That's almost as good as an L322.
Oh no, give up.
To me, in my defence, right? So I was at the Practical Classics show at the NEC on Friday, and there was one in the sale at the Iconic Auctioneer sale.
Yes.
And I filmed it for you, especially for you.
Did like a special video.
Video for Martin.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of car. A guide of 5,000 or 6,000 for the V8 one, wasn't it?
We haven't looked
at it. We need to look at what it went for.
What we do know what price the King Charles 90 made.
Had a guide of 42,000 to 50,000, and a lot of people on our socials said that will never make that. But it did. It exceeded it. But you've just given it away.
Ruined
now.
The surprise now.
£60,000 plus 12% buyer's premium plus the VAT. So it's in total, that is 15% on top of £60,000.
But that's almost regular money for a defender these days. For
not
nice
for that
tiny
one,
defender.
Though. Not for that
was it,
one.
Was it an old working truck? Was it?
It's a Hardtop 90. It wasn't special. Especially in the fact that who owned it.
Yeah. But I think, well, as we've said before, I think defenders have reached their peak and they're settling a bit now, price-wise. But people who've got them are still well and truly invested in making them last as long as possible, which is great news.
That's going to go on forever, though, I think. I think defenders still get, it's that iconic, I know it's a word that's used a lot, but iconic British vehicle, isn't it?
Do you see, a couple of months back, there was a thing flashed up on the TikTok. And there was annoying TikTok voices, and he said, and basically it was a Land Rover, a 110, all done up with a trailer to suit.
Ah, yes.
Went through Barrett Jackson in America for $400,000.
That was actually a Santana 109 with a military trailer, and it was all been tarted up to look like Jurassic Park themed, hadn't it?
Right, so I haven't seen
it. Yeah, if you've never seen it.
When you
Jurassic
say military,
Park,
do you mean as in Sankey type trailer?
I believe it was, wasn't it?
I'm not sure. It was just a silly little TikTok or something.
It had, it was a Santana long wheelbase with like a frame on it, and it was covered in lights.
$400,000.
It was like Tonka toy spec, basically, and $400,000 ridiculous. But someone was there at the rock,
if
that's the new dynamic of Land Rover ownership, then it just means that companies like this and a myriad of other companies will survive because there is that enthusiasm for the mark, and it needs to be that. I think if you work pretty, I don't think you'd even have to work that hard, but you could put a brand new Land Rover together now just from the aftermarket parts that are available. The only thing you might struggle with is maybe axles. You'll probably get somebody who'll do Spider Tracks will do a set that'll suit it.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
If you go to somebody like Hobson, they've got piles of them.
Yeah, what I'm saying is everything's out there to put brand new ones together.
Brand new old stock.
Yeah.
They have some really interesting stuff for sale, actually. Hobson Industries, like new 300 TDIs, new R380 gearboxes and all sorts of stuff, and it's like built something.
Was that 2.8 TGV motor, weren't they? Created TGV 2.8,
really
nice motor.
Yeah. Well, you built one then, the LRO 90, didn't you? The
yeah, 2.8. That was a motor and diesel, using the MWM parts and a brand new cylinder head and hybrid turbo. It's a great thing. Unfortunately, we didn't have the foresight to change the auto box for an R380, so all that lovely low down torque was lost through the torque converter. But it's a great engine.
Mm. What about the 8-speed BMW conversions they're doing now?
Getting popular, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. The M57.
M57s, yeah. We do a lot of chassis with that, ready converted.
Yeah.
Ready to bolt up to, yeah.
I can see why. It's a great... That, yeah, a decent M57 with an 8-speed box is all the engine you'll ever need in a Defender. Yeah.
And now we're getting asked more and more for electric versions of
We've had a few Defender. Electric people come around and say, we want to start making these. Is well, you come up with a recipe.
Tell us what you want, and we'll put the frame.
We'll tell you how we can do it, and we'll build them.
I suppose it has to be fairly viable, doesn't it? It's like you can't just make them.
Well, it's turned it into a proper Chelsea tractor, then.
Yeah, it is.
You can actually just ULEZ compliant, bomb around London picking the kids up from private school or whatever you're doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But we've tried to do $50,000
for the.
We've tried to do this a few times for people where they want specifics, like Tomcat or somebody. They want theirs to do a specific thing. We say, well, we can have an off-the-shelf chassis for you that suits what you need. So if you want to go that route and you want something regular and often that's to a pattern, we'll do that.
A lot of the old chassis now are just sort of getting to the age where they're beyond repair and really they need full replacement.
So a company like that changes this every time they change it to that, they change so that fits. We can do that from the word go. So that's how we do it.
Do you ever get odd requests for older school type stuff, like a series chassis with coil spring mounts and things like that?
We go. I mean, we get asked for them. We do try and talk people out of it. I mean, the latest one, we've got a guy with an 80 who wants to coil it, and he's like, "Are you mental?" I mean, there was a thing, isn't there? There was a thing in the early 80s, wasn't it, where you took a knackered two-door V8 Range Rover and you took an 80-inch Land Rover, and you took what is ostensibly what £200,000 worth of car in today's sort of market.
Back then, they were just throwaway.
So you've taken the £120,000 Land Rover restored Range Rover two-door classic and the £80,000 Land Rover restored Series 180, and you mashed them together and you turned them into a £1,000 trailer. Nice job.
It was really fast. You got two rotten Range Rovers, cut them in half, and then welded the fronts together.
Interestingly, we've got a chassis that's come for resto out there. Is it an 80?
Yeah, we've just started doing chassis restorations, and this guy's...
You say that, I saw the bits. It's literally in bits, isn't it?
We've got two in at the minute. Okay. I haven't showed you the other one.
Oh, okay.
Because it's hilarious, right? This thing's been... It's an 80 and it's been set up on coils and what have you. And the guys want... And it's been used as a trailer, right? And it had a mini engine in the middle of it.
Oh, I've seen this on eBay.
Mini automatic.
I think I saw this when it was on eBay.
So it's had a mini automatic. So the guy's brought the chassis back to us because he wants to put it back to an 80. And he wants us to quote on repairing this chassis. Well, it's got so many bits welded to it. I reckon we've got 20 hours with an angle grinder just getting all the stuff off it. But it's set up for coil sprung with a mini engine mounted in the middle of it.
Because when you restore one, the idea is you keep as much
of the originality.
You keep it.
Yeah. You want to keep the originality there.
And to keep bits that are viable, you think, oh, I'm still using the same bit. But it's going to cost you a lot to save that bit.
That's
the
it's labour that costs.
Because the big issue now with a lot of the 80s and things like that, they are getting really, really thin. They've had 70 years of corrosion, just gentle surface corrosion on them.
Yeah.
They only started out at 2 mil thick. So now they're probably down to 1.6, and then a few dimply holes in and probably nearly through. So you've got to start questioning the validity of
which is
the restoration you're doing.
If all it's going to do is drive on and off the trailer on a showground,
yeah,
it's all right. But if you're going to go out and bash it around, perhaps...
How are you going to, is it a trailer tire?
There's so many fewer Landers getting bashed around now like that.
You can't afford to bash them
around. No, you can't. They're museum pieces.
I say bring back bashing around. It's much more fun.
Yeah, decal Landrovers. Yeah, back to how it was.
Back in old days.
It's back in our day.
It's not bashing it around anymore. It's patina.
Oh yeah, sorry. Yeah.
You need some patina.
Patina.
There's enough patina on that other series one chassis we looked at earlier. Bikey is like a box of beaks, isn't it?
It came on a Euro pallet, basically.
Yeah.
It's folded up onto a Euro pallet.
Yeah, we do have a chassis that arrived in three separate pieces that needs restoring, which is it's going to be really interesting. The rear crossmember came in a carrier bag. It'd been swept into a carrier bag and
so, can you put this back
just a few bits.
But it's original, so it doesn't matter.
There's certain bits on it we'll save. Like we'll keep some of the suspension.
The cliche of Trigger's broom, it'll still be original.
Yeah, exactly. Still the original. It's still got the original engine mount with the chassis number on it.
Trigger's broom. Exactly. That's a phrase we're hearing a lot. It is.
Most Land Rovers like
they are. It's the ultimate rebuildable Meccano kit car, isn't it?
We're proud to partner with Adrian Flux, an insurance broker that specialises in covering all types of Land Rovers, including classic, ex-military, modified and Q-plated models. Adrian Flux offers a range of optional extras to make the policy your own and can provide cover for off-roading, green laning, agreed value and build-up cover. Plus, they even offer a discount of up to 15% for Owners Club members. Simply search Adrian Flux Land Rover Insurance for more information or call them directly on 0344 728 0417 for a quote.
So, I've learned a lot in the time I've been. I've never been here before, but I've picked up, you guys have said stuff that's really stuck in my mind. One of those things, Duncan, you said about why it's never a good idea to galvanise a used chassis. And I'd never thought of this before, but you really, a pearl of wisdom.
As far as I can work out, a lot of the chassis came with paint inside now, before I think Ford got all of them. So you take your chassis down for a shot blasting. You take all the paint off the outside. Then you take it for a dip. At that point, there's still paint on the inside. So it goes through the acid, which denatures the paint a little bit. Then it goes through the actual 450 centigrade.
The heat of a galvanising.
Denatures the paint even more, but doesn't actually galvan on it.
It's not hot enough to burn the paint off completely.
So it's got two jobs at that point, to burn the paint off to then adhere to the metal.
Paint won't burn off till getting way up to nearly 1,000 degrees. The zinc's only at 455.
If you use a blowtorch on paint, it doesn't just disappear. No, you have to scrape it as well. So you've got a layer of something that the galv doesn't really want to stick to. Then you take it out on the roads, bit of damp, boom, it's gone.
So now the paint's gone and there's no galv.
So any protection you had inside has now disappeared. So it's all nice and zinky on the outside.
Well, a lot of galvanised chassis from, unless they're pickled properly, and not just a quick dip like they get at the galv shop, unless they're pickled properly, the paint's still there.
Right.
And what's left of the paint is still there.
Yeah. So you've actually seen them when they strip these body tubs down of cars, haven't you, when they're dipping Mark II Escort shells and stuff like that.
Mark II
Escorts. I'm not even going to go there. But
sounds like a story there.
Yeah.
How many times did you used to go and get the old free press out on a Friday? Escort, £30. Just go out and buy it, drive it for 2 months with an MOT on it and whatever, and then drive it into the scrapyard and get your £30 back off
the
scrapyard.
In those days,
How much would you be worth if you kept all of those Mark I and Mark II Escorts you had?
It's
a joy, isn't it? Anyway, we divulged.
It's not impossible to get a good galv on a second-hand chassis, but
they just rot from
the
inside.
There's another thing that happens when your steel delaminates, because it gets faster.
It splinters, doesn't it? It's actually like slate, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's kind of like layers and layers.
Yeah. If you weigh an old chassis before it's even galvanized, they're a lot heavier than ours that are made of thicker stuff. You can barely turn the things over. So this then soaks up loads of galv on the inside because there's places for it to get into and stick to.
And it galvanises all the shot from the blasting as well.
And the rust that's there, they end up being really heavy. So there's a few reasons why I don't recommend galvanising an old chassis. you're better off just cleaning it up and then wax oiling the inside.
The favourite one though is after a couple of years, all the internal structure will have rusted out inside your freshly galvanised chassis. So any integrity it once had is fast disappearing inside out. It's just rotting from the inside.
We would say this, wouldn't we? Don't galvanise your
own chassis. By all means, repair them and restore them, but don't galvanise them. It'll just kill them.
You're probably going to kill it quicker.
Right. Kill it quicker.
I was going to say, it's interesting. Back to the bulkhead thing then. So when I put my sort of thoughts out on social media or whatever, for every person that said, go galvanised, somebody else said, go e-coated. So you offer... bulkers, you offer two coatings.
We offer both. The reason we've done it is the galvanised bulkhead looks a bit wavy and a bit the galvanising process in itself denatures the steel a bit and it just turns and wavy.
As in it just makes it ripple a little bit.
It just makes it ripple.
So your body shop has more work to do. Yeah, you were saying in the construction of a bulkhead earlier, even at the factory, they would use...
Oh, the spiller on a genuine bulkhead as it comes out of the factory. Before, you know, there's welds on the bulkhead that they flash over and then they'll paint over them and just to make them look nice. And it's usually the bit behind where the wing bolt's on, there's a bit of filler in there. And that's the only spot. Ours are exactly the same, so it's one of those areas, if you overgrind it, you will take away any integrity there, and there's about four panels that join at that point.
Come together at that point.
Four panels come together at that point, and if you remove all the weld, then there's no strength holding it together, and it'll just break apart. The whole structure will fail.
Just take the high bit off, and then it gets flashed over.
So there is filler on bulkheads to start with, but it depends what you want to do with your truck. If you are rebuilding your truck and you just want a serviceable Land Rover that's going to last forever and go trugging around fields and green laning, then get a galvanised bulkhead, spend a bit extra having it painted to make it at least look sensible and nice. And but how long do you need that bulkhead to last? Realistically, you're working on a vehicle where the bulkhead's already lasted 40 years.
Like mine, exactly. Yeah. 40 years this year.
Bulkhead's already 40 years
old.
Mine's
got knackered 5 years ago. Might have a few footwells in it.
Hopefully my lad will still be making bulkheads in another 40 years. So if your kids want to come along and put a new bulkhead on it in 40 years, I'm sure my lad would love to see them.
Do you know what? My kids have got zero interest in Land Rovers. Zero. I think, just like I have got zero interest in antiques, because my dad was... into antiques, and it was forced upon me. I think I forced Land Rovers upon them. They're not interested.
Well, my lad has not had a choice.
This is where you're working.
He left school at 16 and came to work here as an apprentice here at 16 years old.
But he looks like he's enjoying himself there.
Oh, he loves it.
Restoring a chassis is somewhat different to, say, making one, isn't it?
He absolutely loves it, and he's got 4 years to prove himself. So he's going to be running it because I'm off. Four years, I want to be gone.
That boat building that you started out.
It's not like that.
I'm just
going to build a 130 Overlander and disappear for a couple of years.
Okay, interesting.
Sails twice a week anyway.
Sail every week anyway. Yeah.
Oh, you are into the boats.
Proper dinghy sailing, yeah.
I used to do it as when we were kids, but I say kids, 20s. But I stopped and he stopped and then he started and I didn't.
Okay.
Yeah. The older I get, the better I was.
Yeah, yeah. Same for everyone, isn't it, really? I noticed when we rocked up, you were a bit of a Triumph man. Last week we spoke about Triumph stags.
Steve's got a bit of a thing for a stag.
All of a sudden, right, I've just like...
One of the nicest sounding standard V8s.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
Al used to have a stag, didn't
he? Yeah, I think you've seen when he came here last time, didn't you?
It was myself and Ed Evans, our technical editor, came here, and he's a Triumph man. In fact, I think he used to be a tech editor in Triumph World magazine back in the day.
I've no idea.
And he sat in it, and I sat in it, and I was like, oh, this is nice.
So, they're a nice place to be, this.
Yeah. They are nice, they're small, aren't
they? And the stuff about them being massively unreliable and all the rest of it. It's all been sorted. You can do it.
Coolant in them and
make sure they're cleaned out on the heads and stuff. Once you've rebuilt one properly, they're absolutely
phenomenal
fine.
Car.
Nice old bus. It's quite effortless.
Yeah.
I have to say, as someone who's never really been that enamoured with British sports cars, when we turned up and saw the GT6 outside, I didn't
think... GT6 is very special because it's never, ever been welded.
Which is like probably the,
which is probably the only one in existence. Yeah, I think somebody put a tiny patch in it somewhere, and it's about 2 inches square.
But it's like, that's... Yeah,
right, but it's been properly never, done, yeah. And then it has been painted, but it's never been welded other than that one bit.
Yeah, you've had that for a few years, have you?
I've had that a fair few years.
Yeah.
It's been to Le Mans, and it's broke down at Spa. On the track. Managed to weld the input shaft into the back of the engine. The gearbox input shaft into the back of the engine.
It did have a...
Wow.
It has got Toyota 5-speed in it. But
it's got Toyota Supra 5-speed gearbox,
really?
In it, yeah.
And wow.
It was
triple wedders.
Nice. LA 2.5 straight six?
No, it's a 2-litre, that one.
Two-litre?
Two-litre with triple Webers on it.
Right, okay.
It's not good. It's well overfueled.
Yeah, nice thing, though.
Yeah, really nice, so I have to say.
Do you know the reason why you're thinking of they're coming on to the line? It's because you're getting a bit older.
Do you reckon that
you're
is?
Turning into a man.
I'm certainly getting grey enough.
I've had a Spitfire I've had since. I got it in 99. We put it on the road in 2004 because Al said to me one day, shall we go to see? It was the second running of the Le Mans Classic. Shall we go? Shall we get that Spitfire done? We'll go in it. So we spent the winter doing it. And yeah. I've spent 20-something odd years arsing around with it, really.
Yeah, just enjoying it.
Yeah, that's on Webers. It's on a little 3.5 kilo flywheel, and it's got a 5-speed 4 box. And it's, yes, you can get things that are way faster. Just, but that's not the point. One thing, the messing around with it, that's the point.
Yeah, it's that's what makes it a hobby, isn't it?
Yeah. If anything about Triumphs, you get to kill yourselves at a lot lower speeds.
Yeah, you know, I've done laps around the full Le Mans circuit. I've done Spa. I've done quite a few tracks in this country,
yeah,
just driving it.
Donington and
but there's no reason to sell that because it, you know, it's cheap to very cheap.
Yeah, very cheap. Yeah,
cheap to insure, no tax. Yeah, just sits there until it wants it.
Yeah,
fire it up and away we go. It's good fun.
I think with cars like that though, of a certain age, obviously they tend to follow the owner's age, don't they? The car that you
yeah.
want to have. So. But whereas like Land Rovers are kind of exempt from that, but they well, appeal to that. So
yeah, I mean,
people.
Your proofing point is my lad. He's 26 years old, and I said to him, "What classic car would you like?"
Time for you to get something interesting.
Yeah, time for you to get an interesting car to come out and play with us. Oh, what, a Nissan 350Z.
Yes,
yeah,
so to
he's
me,
got
that's
a 350Z,
like modern, yeah.
But it's also got an 80. Work that one out.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I do sit between the two. Pretty much 10 years between the two, actually.
Yeah.
Hero cars for me were stuff that you'd see on Gran Turismo 2 on the PlayStation, so R34 Skyline, Supras, RX-7s, all that
yeah.
stuff.
Lewis is exactly the same.
That I'll never yeah. own now, because now that America can get them, the prices
well,
are
in Vogue
stratosphere,
aren't they?
Yeah.
That's what that age people buy.
Skylines were always hard to come across anyway, weren't they? Mm. Couldn't find them
free
that much.
Japanese
yeah.
bought Skyline, yeah.
But for a good few years, they were what you call, well, they were attainable. But
yeah,
then, I mean,
you're sure many of them. You know.
Yeah, exactly. They're all over in Ireland getting the
yeah
backs on thrash kicked around Mondello.
Yeah.
But yeah,
okay.
No, it's just an interesting thing. But like you say though, Land Rovers have sort of avoided that, and it doesn't matter how
they're
old you are. Kids love Land Rovers. People who are getting into driving, they're seeing them as you know exciting and cool. And then obviously. You know, older guys and girls are well into them as well. So they've kind of dodged that whole bullet.
They've always been other.
Mm.
There's only one category they fit in.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So it's not like do I get an XR2 or do I get a 205? You either get a Land Rover or you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I was in the Land Rover camp back when I was 18, 19, and
yeah.
people were in Cavalier SRIs and Astra
yeah.
GTEs. Oh, and
one of my first cars, I used to run around in a V6 blooming Essex engined air portable that would
really?
Pass
yeah.
any,
oh,
yeah.
nice. I've had exactly the same air portable
would pass anything except a petrol station
yeah.
the lightweight
yeah.
lightweight might but
I've never
you've pushed one
lightweight.
Yeah.
I noticed you called it an air portable rather than lightweight, which is
half
unusual.
Ton
yeah.
air portable
yeah,
yeah.
If only it weighed half a ton.
The footwells used to get really hot, didn't they, with the Essex engine conversion?
Cause
the the manifold was basically touched the footwell, didn't it? Yeah, driver's side.
Yeah. Don't talk to me about hot footwells. Rover V8 between you. Oh, during the
of
passenger.
Course, yeah, yeah.
None
yeah.
of you have driven a GT6. I'm sorry.
No, I haven't.
No.
I've only just discovered
GT6
how gorgeous
has got
they are.
A six-cylinder heater element right in the middle of the gear and a cardboard tunnel to protect you from it. So me and the lad were going.
So you never cold then?
He never ever cold. Me and the lad were going down. Well, we were following my mate Ian in his GT6, and we were going through Rouen on the way to Le Mans one year, and it was a comfortable 30, 32 degrees outside. Every time we pulled up at traffic lights, the doors got flung open
really,
just to try and get out. Some air in it.
Yeah. Wow. Outside, pour water in.
Well, 32 felt cool.
So hot in that car. It must have been, 50 degrees inside. It was. I mean, it got ridiculous. It got to a point where we were stopping and getting T-shirts and jeans and dunking them in buckets of water and pouring water all over them and wetting them and then putting them back on, and in 20 minutes all your clothes were dry again. So you'd have to stop and change into it again.
The joys of British motoring. Yeah.
Oh, you can tell they're built for the UK where you don't really need aircon, can't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The
964s
are a lot nicer.
No, they're very compact little thing, aren't they?
When you see a car like that, though, you realise how small cars were back in the, when they say
well,
back in
like,
the day.
You realise how absolutely enormous they are now.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've gone. They're just like huge, massive, great wide things.
Even his 964 looks tiny compared to
my mate's. My mate's got a 992, and you park the 964 next to it, and it's almost like it's 50% bigger.
But the 992 Porsche. That's the new.
That's
one,
the latest one.
Oh, they're hideously.
They're huge.
Huge. They're like huge. SUV size. It's crazy.
Even like Volvo estates, like normal cars are enormous now compared to like.
I remember when I was. When I was young.
We're sounding like Mike Told Duffers, by the way.
Yeah.
Just saying, you know.
I remember,
back in my day.
Back when I was. You see Granada, and you think,
that's
a big car. That's a big, have you seen a Granada?
They're tiny. Yeah, they are absolutely
tiny.
They're tiny
now.
Mark 1,
yeah.
Mark 2, yeah.
I see one occasionally around here, and I think, that is. They used to be massive when I was a kid, but not anymore.
We used to think series Land Rovers were big. But
yeah, they're not.
They're
nice and narrow.
They're only a bit bigger
got
than
a
Mini.
They've got about
the
same wheel
the size of a Mini
your
now.
Your GT6.
Yeah.
Well, it's like the old, when the Freelander 2 came out, that was the same body dimensions as a Discovery 1.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same, like,
and yet,
just
visually,
think
you think of Freelander 2 as being a
small
car, but
yeah.
Not.
No.
So anyway, what's better for the world than a 3-ton SUV or a nice lightweight Series 2?
Exactly, I think.
Yeah. When were you ever going to hear the sentence, a lightweight Land Rover?
Yeah, exactly.
And not laugh.
Yeah.
But compared to modern stuff, they are, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. And thankfully people are, like you say, putting the time and the money into keeping them going and giving them a good home and enjoying them for what they are, which is the main thing. And long may it continue.
The only thing that will knock them off the road is legislation.
Yeah, and the way things are going at the moment, that might be sooner rather than later.
I can't see that.
They're trying hard.
There's a witch hunt
but
on it.
But there is a hell of a lot of industry, for want of a better term, and commerce around old Land Rovers. Huge amount.
I don't know what the market is now for companies that work Land Rovers, and
there's whole market
of people
still
employed.
Worth millions, isn't it? And millions to the country.
Yeah.
In terms
God,
of
how boring is that when we're talking about blowing the
state of the economy?
And on that note, I think actually we'll wind this up. We're over an hour, and the recorder is shouting low battery at me, which is making me nervous. So, thank you ever so much for having us.
Thank you for coming.
We're going to whiz around with the camera now and get some footage for YouTube, because that's the kind of guys we are.
And then finishing up with loading up the new bulkhead.
Exciting.
Take it back to the workshop.
Yeah, the next big piece for the Land Rover.
I'm keen.
Right.
Keen to crack on.
You'll be keen until you're 2 days into swapping those bits of wire over.
Yeah, I know.
Now the last bit you take off a bulkhead is the first bit you fit on it.
Yeah. You're at the bottom of a big mountain here.
It's
taken you 4 years to change your chassis as well. This is going to be hilarious.
I'll see you in 5 years, yeah.
Well, you'll see it on YouTube, on the LRM YouTube channel and the magazine. And you'll probably hear about it on here as well. But yeah, for now, we'll catch you next week.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Bye for now.
Cheers.